While I'm speaking, I'll pass around some pictures talking about this trip to Shaolin are reminding me that I have this photo album, and so this is a view from the from Bodhidharma's cave, looking down at the fields below. You can see how high up it is, and this is the entrance to the cave where they've built a kind of entranceway, and it says the calligraphy above says "Silent Mystery Abode." Silent Mystery Abode is the kind of the name of this cave. I thought that's a beautiful way to describe the entrance to Bodhidharma's realm. Silent Mystery Abode. And then there's a picture inside the cave, and then a picture of me with these Chinese pilgrims that helped us find the way. And I think this is the nun's temple at the bottom of the mountain. In the introduction to this Transmission of Light record by Francis Cook, he has a wonderful, extensive introduction here. And this is a maybe kind of summary of Transmission of Light record. Francis Cook says, "In the course of documenting the ancestral succession over the generations, Keizan centers his talks primarily on two topics." These sound familiar again and again, almost all these talks. One topic is the necessity to be totally committed to realizing awakening, to take the Zen life most seriously, and to make a supreme effort in Zen practice. This is also a focal point in Dogen's writing, and both these teachers, as ancestors, are equally concerned with the training of disciples and selection of successors. The second emphasis, and indeed the overwhelmingly central focal point of all these chapters, is the light. The light of the title of the work. It is this light that is transmitted from teacher to disciple as the disciple discovers this light within him or herself. In fact, once the light is discovered, this is the transmission. The light is one's Buddha nature, or true self. Keizan uses a number of striking and provocative epithets and titles for this true self, including, in quotes, "true self," unquote. And this term may originate in the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, the subject of our upcoming class series. Provocatively and radically speaking of Buddha nature as our true Atman, our true self. And Keizan doesn't shy away from talking about the true self in a tradition that teaches not self as its one of its central tenets. Other epithets Keizan uses for Buddha nature are "that one," "that person," "the old fella," "the old gal," and "lord of the house." And Francis Cook says, "such language is uncommon in Dogen's writings, as is the focus on discussing the existence and nature of this old fellow." But that is part of what constitutes Keizan Zen as distinct from Dogen Zen. I thought that's a nice summary. Because if you read the Shobo Genzo and Dogen's teachings a lot, and you read this transmission of light of Keizan, you start to feel that they really do have a little bit of a different flavor, these two versions of Zen from these two co-founders of Soto Zen in Japan. Keizan was completely devoted to Dogen's teachings, although he never met Dogen. And yet he turned it in a little bit new way. Almost every chapter celebrates this true self. And the more I study this transmission of light, the more I love our ancestor Keizan. The 29th ancestor, China's second ancestor, great master Da Zu Hui Ke, which means great ancestor wisdom ability, wisdom capacity, studied with the 28th ancestor and attended to him. One day, he said to the ancestor, Bodhidharma, I have put an end to all conditions. So in translation. I have stopped all relations. I have ceased all involvements, he says, as a kind of like way of meeting in Dokusan, in the cave, in the snow. And Bodhidharma asks, well, doesn't that result in death? Or another translation, doesn't that result in nihilism? I've ended all relations, involvements, and conditions. Isn't that nihilism? And, or annihilationism? And Hueka says, no, it doesn't result in nihilism, or death. And Bodhidharma said, what's your proof, or verification, that this ending of all involvements is not just nihilism? And Hueka says, I am always clearly aware, therefore words are inadequate. Or, there is always perfect clear awareness and words don't reach it. And Bodhidharma said, this is the essence of mind verified by all Buddhas. Have no doubt. This is the story. One of my favorite stories. In my early days of practice, I remember my teacher, Tenshin Roshi, bring up this story so often. Hueka said, I like that way of saying it, I have ended all involvements. The Chinese character N is, could be translated like that. Relations, relationships could be translated. For Sanskrit fans, it's the character used to translate pratyaya, which means like conditions, but yeah, conditions is N. They use it, and they use it for like praticca samuppada. So conditioned, dependent, all dependency, all conditioning, all relations, like that. All conditions have ended. All relationships have ended. All involvements with anything have ended. Sounds almost like death, doesn't it? Bodhidharma says, isn't that death? If there's no relationship with anything, if there's no involvement with anything, with anything, isn't that nihilism, which is like nothingnessism? And Waika says, no, it's not nihilism. Bodhidharma says, well, prove it. And Waika's statement is, there is always a clear awareness and words don't reach it. Which, just like the former story we heard, right, where the former commentary of Kazan, where he said, this is not nothingness. This signlessness is not nothingness. It's clear and bright. Almost the same in this story. This ending of involvement or relations is not nothingness. It's always clearly aware and words don't reach it. For we could even translate it as there is perfect eternal awareness. It would be a fine translation of Jo Chi. Jo means always, but also means permanent or eternal. And Chi, or Jir in Chinese, is the character that translates the Sanskrit jnana. 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 With a J in front. Not dhyana, but jnana. Jnana, nya is like the English root of like knowing, knowledge and gnosis. Yeah, so really Sanskrit and English share many roots. And the Sanskrit nya is in prajna. It's like a complete knowing, wisdom. Vijnana is consciousness, dualistic consciousness. And jnana is like translated as knowing or awareness, usually. And usually non-dual knowing, as opposed to vijnana is dualistic knowing. And yes.
Eternal here implies there being non-arising and non-ceasing.
Yeah. If something's eternal, it doesn't arise and cease. Exactly. And you might appreciate this jnana is what's translated in Tibetan as yeshe. Yeshe. It's used a lot sometimes translated as like timeless awareness. So I am always clearly aware maybe misses some of that sense of there's no I in the Chinese. It's more like Bodhidharma says prove it, and Waika says it is eternal awareness. It is unchanging knowing, experiencing without coming and going and without duality of subject and object. And words can't reach it. When Tenzin Roshi talked about this, sometimes he would say, this clear knowing, there's words flying all around it, and this flurry of words flying all around this clearly aware, but they never actually touch it. But it's not like there's no words in the vicinity. Just the words don't touch it. Yes.
So then that would point to the original qualities of no reference points and aimlessness.
Yeah.
The non-duality of aimlessness.
Yep.
And no wall, no bounds, no reference points.
Yeah, this morning we talked about signlessness, emptiness, and aimlessness. So, those are all descriptions, qualities of this always clearly aware. And it might sound like it's some special state or something hidden way back in the recesses of the storehouse consciousness or something, which is why we can appreciate why the Zen ancestors also called it ordinary mind. It's not actually hidden away. It's not a special state acquired by long-term meditators. It is everybody's always present nature. That's how Buddha nature is. It's the awareness which is hearing these words now. It's the awareness that's seeing the Zendo, it's the awareness that's feeling a grumble in the belly, it's the awareness of thoughts. But all these sound like, don't they sound like just dualistic consciousness? Because these are all objects, these sounds and these sights and these sensations and these thoughts. So, Weka said that all involvements with any thing have ended. So, yet there's this clear awareness. So one way we could look at this is involvements with things means that the things have to be separate from the one that's involved in them. Relationship is always to something else. In these words, right? Conditions involve multiple things. So if conditions and involvements and relationships have ceased, and yet this ancestor is able to talk and walk and speak and hear, and how is this so? So if we say that this jnana, this awareness or this knowing is, has no edges or boundaries, like was mentioned in this morning's verse, then there's nothing outside of it. That's what no edges or boundaries means, does it not? As soon as there's an edge, then there's something outside it. If we say the universe is expanding and it has an edge and it's moving in, it's expanding, then we have to say, well, then there's something outside the universe that it's moving into. And if we say the universe is truly infinite and has no edge, that our minds cannot get a hold of such an idea, can they? That's why looking at the night sky is a nice practice. And considering how there's no end to this space. And there's no end. If that's, we're talking about outer space, if we talk about so-called inner space, there's no end to that either. These are not really outer and inner, because that's division. But knowing space, aware space, we can look for in our meditation, look for the boundaries or edges of our ordinary, ever-present knowing awareness. Really explore what it would mean for awareness to have no edge or boundary. we're looking at the wall period after period, does our awareness go out and meet that wall as an object outside itself? Or without moving a particle, can we relate to this wall gazing in a slightly different way? Playfully trying on the possibility that what if that wall is, what if awareness is not like emanating out from, in this case, our eyes, this kind of seeing the wall as a kind of seeing awareness. What if it's not coming out from our eyes, but what if it's just an all-encompassing awareness in which the wall is appearing? A boundless knowing in which sounds are arising and ceasing. A big, spacious experiencing in which sensations and thoughts and feelings are coming and going. Yeah, that slight shift. It's just a different way of relating to our experience. You know, we can, what if it is that way? We can explore this in our own experience. These are words that, that can loosen up our usual way of perceiving experiences. What if they're not outside of mind, but arising within a boundless, edgeless space with no outside? Then, if this was the case, then could we not say that there is no involvement in external phenomena anymore? There's no relationships with others anymore. Of course, there's an appearance of Kokyo talking with Corrine and seeing her and her seeing me, but what if it's not really that I'm over here looking at you over there, but that we're both appearances arising in the same space of boundless awareness? Then we don't have a relationship anymore. I'm sorry. We don't have a relationship. We are just two appearances in one reality. To see how we can talk about that is, it's the realm of no relationship with any other. Conventionally speaking, we can say the appearance of Kokyo and the appearance of Corrine are having a relationship within the one space of ever-present knowing. But strictly speaking, there's no actual relationship because there's no other. And there's no involvement with things. They'd have to step a little bit outside the boundary of awareness in order to be involved with them, wouldn't they? Yeah. As soon as there's a grasper, there's grasped. As soon as there's grasped, there's a grasper. And that's how our life usually appears. But what if grasper and grasped are both appearances arising in the same one space? Just like this, in the same one space as the Zendo we're sharing, Corrine and Kokyo seem to be arising in this shared space of the, we call the Zendo. What if it's the shared space of knowing or awareness in which the multiplicity of 10,000 things comes to be arising and ceasing. From the point of view of the 10,000 things, there's constant relationship and involvement and conditionality, interdependence, right? From the point of view of the 10,000 things. From the point of view of the one space in which they're happening, there's no relationship, conditionality, or appearances. It's an unconditioned space because there's nothing outside it to condition it. There's nothing that it depends on, because in order to depend on anything else, there'd have to be an else. It might sound kind of complex, but this is a subtle way of just relating to our own present experience right now. And I think in Sesshin, we naturally start opening to this space more and more easily and without even hearing all this kind of thing. Partly I think we open to it more naturally because our kind of like obsessively, incessantly thinking mind just starts settling a little bit. The dualistic conceptual thinking mind is what really seems to create involvement. It's not like it has to end, but it's just, as it settles more, we feel more spacious.
But these are only questions that the dualistic mind can pose.
Yeah, we're talking with any thing in words is kind of like dualistic minds, relating to dualistic minds. But may the words take us to the realm that's free of words. Not necessarily where there are no words. That's why I appreciate Tenzin Roshi's saying, it's not that there's all thoughts and words disappear. This realm of always clearly aware, there's words, and I think we mean here thoughts. Lots of them, swarming like a beehive, are wildly and chaotically all around this ever-present awareness, but they don't touch it. It's one image. Maybe another image that maybe even more clear is they're not so much around it and can't touch it. This swarming beehive of thoughts is swarming around in awareness, right? Because there's nothing outside it. And as long as it remains within awareness and not outside of it, these buzzing bees of thought cannot touch it. Right? If you're like, if these buzzing bee-like thoughts of all our conditioned thinking are something separate from the awareness, then they could touch it. But if they're just awareness taking the shape of all kinds of crazy thoughts and painful feelings and clear thoughts and blissful feelings and everything in between, they don't touch the realm that is all-inclusive. So, Hueka says, all involvements have ceased. Bodhidharma, in order to test him, says, I assure you don't have like a nihilistic understanding of all involvements have ceased. You might just say like, you stop thinking. And I'm not that interested in you stopping thinking. Isn't that nihilism, or just stopping thinking? And Hueka says, no, it's not nihilism. I'm not talking about just stopping thinking. Bodhidharma says, well then, how are you going to prove that there's no involvement even while there's thinking going on? It is perfectly complete, constant knowing is one translation. It is eternal awareness, and words can't reach it.
All involvements have ceased, and then what is the vow of the Bodhisattva? Or why did the Buddha teach after the work?
Because
the
Buddhism and Bodhisattvas, from this new perspective, could then see that all beings are themselves, and they themselves are all beings. There's no involvement because there's not the slightest separation. And from this boundless, all-inclusive, non-separation, if part of oneself is in pain, we naturally want to respond.
Yeah.
If our arm gets cut,
relationship is sort of almost like an internal working of the body.
Yeah. As I was going to say, if our arm is cut, then a lot of all the platelets, is it the white blood cells, come to heal it without any effort at all, right? They're just taking care of what needs to be taken care of without any even intention. It's natural. And we could say
spontaneous.
Yes.
Which seems like a complicated thing to do that way.
But that was a completely... He almost didn't, as the story goes, because he thought it would be too complicated.
Mm-hmm.
He thought, it's too subtle. I won't be able, this cannot be conveyed in words. And all kinds of energies and parts of himself said, please, just give it a try. Otherwise, it's going to be eons till someone like you appears and can maybe help deeply like this. So, yes. And Bodhidharma liked this answer. I am always clearly aware. There is always clear awareness, and words can't reach it. Bodhidharma said, this is the essence of mind verified by all Buddhas. Have no doubt. It's kind of like his confirmation. This Chinese character, Qi, or Jir, Jnana, is in early Chan, is really celebrated. Shun Wei is like at the time of the sixth ancestor, and later Zen teacher at Sungmi, and then Korean Zen, Chinul, particularly these three, and probably many others, but these three bring up this quote again and again. I think it's Shun Wei's quote, that he's, this single word, Jir, single character, that means knowing or awareness, this single word is the gate of all mysteries. And so I think in some realms of early Zen in China, they were really into this character that Huayka's bringing up here. This one word, all we need is this one word, awareness, or knowing. That is the gateway, the Dharma gate, to infinite mysteries. So, here's the story of Huayka. He was from Wu Lao, and his family name was Qi. His father was no longer alive. Before his father had children, he would think, our family has always revered the good, so why can't we have children? He prayed for a long time, and one night he saw a strange light illuminating the room, and Hueka's mother became pregnant. When Hueka grew, he was named Guang, or in Japanese, Ko, which means light, because of the auspicious sign of the illuminated room. From childhood, his determination was unusual. He lived a long time in the region of the Yi and Lo rivers and read extensively. He wasn't interested in the family property, but he enjoyed wandering the mountains and rivers. He would lament, "The teachings of Confucius and Lao Tzu are nothing but rules for decorum and the abstruse arts. Teachings of Chuang Tzu and the I Ching do not get to the bottom of the subtle principle." So that's the kind of stuff they read in old China, right? But he kind of felt like though those spiritual texts are great, they don't get to the bottom of the matter, the bottom of the subtle principle. So he left home and received the precepts from Zen teacher Bao Jing of Mount Xiang in Lungmen. He traveled around to discussions of Buddhist teachings and extensively studied the doctrines of the great and small vehicles. One day, he read something about the teaching of prajna in some Buddhist books, and he acquired it spontaneously in a flash. All Buddhas in the 10 directions rely on prajna, paramita, and thus relies unsurpassed, complete, perfect awakening. Maybe he just heard that nya sound, and that was enough to shock him into knowing. I hope it's clear when we use the word knowing here, we're not talking about intellectual knowing. Right? We're not talking about knowing something, knowing some idea. We're just talking about cognizance. Pure knowing is another name for awareness. That kind of knowing. This kind of knowing. The kind that's like ever-present and unchanging. It's another meditation we can do, right? Is to try to discern while we're gazing at the wall whether the as the light on the wall changes over the course of the day, does the knowing of the light on the wall change over the course of the day? Or is it the same knowing? Is it the same knowing that actually hears sounds and sees sights? How could that be the same? That one is seeing and one is hearing, but is the cognizance of sights and sounds the same cognizance? Is it the same awareness that can include multi-sensory experience? We can explore our experience. So after he heard something in some text about prajna, he realized prajna, and after that, he sat peacefully in zazen day and night for 8 years, and in the silence of meditation, a spirit appeared. It said, "If you want to achieve results in your meditation, why be stuck here? Or why linger around here? The great way is not far. Go south." A spirit said to him. Realizing that the light was spiritual help, he changed his name to Shunguang, which means spiritual light, like spirit light, spiritual light, because his name was already light, but now the spirit helped him Shenguang. Or in Japanese it would be like Jinko. The next day, after the spirit told him this, his head hurt so badly, like it, as if it was being stabbed or crushed, like a blaring headache. While his Buddha's teacher was trying to cure his excruciating head pain, a voice from the sky said, "This is the changing of bones, not an ordinary pain." And at that point, Guang told his teacher about seeing the spirit last night. And the master inspected his head and found these five lumps, like mountain peaks, on his head. One commentator says, maybe this refers to the five-pronged Vajra. Which is like a symbol of awakening. Shunguang's teacher said, these signs are auspicious. You will be awakened. The south that the spirit directed you to must refer to the great being Bodhidharma at Shaolin Monastery. He should be your teacher. So receiving this instruction, Guang went to Shaolin Monastery on Mount Sung. It was the ninth day of the 12th month of 528 in our counting system. The great master Bodhidharma would not allow him to enter the room, the cave. And so Sheng Guang stood outside the window. That night it snowed hard, but he remained standing in the snow waiting for dawn. Deepening snow buried him to the waist, and the cold pierced his bones. His falling tears froze drop by drop, making him even colder. He thought to himself, when the ancients sought the way, they broke their bones and extracted the marrow. They drew their blood to relieve the hunger of others. They spread their hair to cover the mud and threw themselves off cliffs to feed tigers. If the ancients were like this, what kind of person am I? So thinking, he strengthened his resolve and remained standing, unmoving and unflinching. So these are ancient stories the Buddha tells about his past life. I think this one story may be the Buddha tells about when he first, the first kind of like inklings of stepping onto the Bodhisattva path. I think this is one in the old sutras where Shakyamuni Buddha, eons ago, in a past life, that stream of causally conditioned consciousness, which of course Shakyamuni Buddha could remember with his complete and all-encompassing full awakening. He could remember everything. And he remembered that in this distant eon, he came upon a Buddha named Dipankara, great lamp Buddha. And that Buddha was like walking along a muddy road and got to the edge of the muddy road and was hesitating about kind of traipsing through the mud in his robes. And the Bodhisattva who would become Shakyamuni Buddha was a dreadlock yogi in India. He had long dreadlocks down to his ankles. And immediately on seeing the radiance of this glowing lamp Buddha, Dipankara Buddha, he spread his dreadlocks out in the mud as a kind of mat, a nice thick mat for Dipankara to walk across the mud, not dirty his feet. And because of that offering to a Buddha, that selfless act, it created the conditions for again and again being born into the bodhisattva path. And in a later lifetime, long before Shakyamuni Buddha came to be the Buddha, he again recalled one time seeing this tigress with her cubs starving due to lack of food, and couldn't stand to see this sight of starving tigress, and knew there was no other food for miles and miles, and she was on the verge of death. So he threw himself off a cliff, and so that tiger and cubs could feed on his body. Again, spontaneous and radical, selfless acts to give oneself to others, and eventually led to becoming Shakyamuni Buddha. So Hueka knows these stories, and he's thinking, wow. He was about to start complaining as the snow came above his waist, and he was freezing there, and Bodhidharma wasn't letting him in. He was about to say, maybe I should call it a day. This guy's a little bit too much. This is getting absurd. But then he remembered these stories, and he strengthened his resolve and stayed. When dawn came, great teacher Bodhidharma saw that he had stood all night in the snow, and he asked, out of compassion, you have stood a long time in the snow, what do you want? And Shengguang said, I beg you, teacher, open the gate of sweet dew of your great compassion and deliver us common beings everywhere. Please teach us the way. The gate of sweet dew is one of the chants that we do here. So it's an old phrase that refers to, sweet dew is the Chinese way of translating amrita, which is like ambrosia, the gate of the elixir of eternal life. Amrita means like the deathless ambrosia that will feed you what you really need. Please open the gate of sweet dew, the door of ambrosia, and deliver us. And Bodhidharma said, the supreme wonderful way of the Buddhas takes eons of diligently practicing what is hard to practice and enduring what is difficult to endure. How can you struggle in vain and hope to obtain the true vehicle with such slight merit, with such little understanding, such shallow mind and conceited pride? These are the words of the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of great, totally selfless compassion, the love ball, Bodhidharma, speaks this way. Strange, huh? And so saying, Bodhidharma ignored Shengguang. When Shengguang heard this compassionate instruction, he heard it as compassionate instruction, he wept even more. His determination to seek the way grew firmer and firmer. And here's the hard part. I know we don't like this part, but it's part of the story. He picked up a sharp sword and cut off his left arm. Bodhidharma then realized that Shengguang was a vessel for the Dharma and said, when Buddhas seek the Dharma in the very beginning, they forget their bodies for the sake of Dharma. You've now cut off your arm in front of me. You have the potential to find the Dharma. You have the capacity, the ability. So then Shengguang then changed his name to Hueka, which means capacity for Dharma, or capacity for wisdom, wisdom ability, and was permitted to enter the room. You know, I like looking through our, we have our Soto Zen ceremony manual. It's all translated into English. It's a big, big old book now. The Soto Shu Gyoji Gihan, which our ceremonies are almost right out of that book. But there's some we don't do. Like, in that text, they have Rohatsu Sesshin, and it ends on December 8th. And the evening of December 8th, they have all-night sitting. We did that in the monastery in Japan. But then there's a Soto Shu tradition that this, they didn't do this at the monastery I practiced, but I think big places like Eheiji and Soji-ji on December 9th, because as the text here says, the ninth day of the 12th month of 528 is when Hueka came up the mountain to meet Bodhidharma and cut off his arm. So the day after Rohatsu Sesshin, it's a very strange thing. It's like, I think they have one day. They have the morning of the 8th, they have the ceremony. Then they can maybe rest all day. And then on the 9th, they sit all night again. I haven't heard of people doing this, but this is how the big monasteries, I think, do it. And that's December 9th, ceremony is called Repaying the Blessings of the Severed Arm. So they have a ceremony to celebrate Hueka, and then they do a memorial service for Hueka on that next morning. So there's something, and I can see why this particular ceremony hasn't really like become popular in America. it's in our Soto tradition, the ceremony of repaying the blessings of the severed arm. And we don't like this story, do we? I don't like it.
I like it.
You like it? Okay.
Yeah, it's cool.
Okay, cool.
And he's frozen. Right?
He's frozen and armless. So maybe it made it easier then, huh?
It was... just stick the end down in the snow to cauterize, you know, to stop the heat.
That's right. That's right. You know... it's a kind of extreme, right? So this is Lex Hickson's kind of, not exactly commentary on the Denko Roku, but like his reflections on, poetic reflections. Lex Hickson's a great practitioner of many traditions, including Soto Zen.
Can you spell his last name?
Lex Hickson?
Yeah.
H-I-X-O-N.
Oh.
Yeah, so his reflection, you know, we don't hear anything much about this cutting off the arm. It's just, why the arm, right? But we don't hear, like, why, right? Does this represent something? So he kind of interprets it as a kind of representation. I like his thoughts here. He says, after severing his own arm, thereby cutting the root of separate body and mind, Hueka received his new name, Wonderful Potential of Wisdom. Words are inadequate. We're not speaking here about arm, sword, blood, or cutting motion. May we cut away obstacles, our own and those of all beings in this global realm, with the clean, clear gaze of naked awareness, the sharpest, brightest sword. That's a palatable interpretation. Yeah, I thought that too. That's a nice that you bring that up. I started thinking about why hands and arms. I'm seeking the way. Please let me in. I'm willing to do anything. Please give it to me. And you're a little bit too lazy. Well, maybe actually it's this grasping that's the problem. Cut off the grasping. And Bodhidharma says, okay, now you don't even want anything. Come on in. Yeah, nice. There's a nice poem of Ikkyu. Ikkyu, the Japanese Rinzai poet, Zen teacher. He says, his poem is, "Don't wait for the man standing in the snow to cut off his arm. Help him now." Ikkyu has another poem. "Even Linji's disciples don't know. So many ordinary people do know, but don't know they know. Walking to work, talking to themselves." So many ordinary people know, but they don't know they know. Walking to work, talking to themselves. I'm going to work today. I'm going to have a time of later.
Is the knowing itself
in
your talking about again?
I would say not really equivalent, but more like vipassana is the insight or the seeing that knowing has no boundaries. So, you know, vipassana maybe could be translated as like special seeing. It's a kind of like it's a kind of meditative insight. That's the seeing of this particular quality of knowing that it has no boundaries or edges, nothing outside of itself, and that it has no coming and going. It doesn't move, and it doesn't exist, and it doesn't not exist either. Yeah, those will all be insights into the various dimensions of this ordinary knowing. Well, this ordinary knowing is not like an insight. Because insight is something that we might have sometimes, and some people might have and not others. But this ordinary awareness is something we all always have all the time. That's why it's a little different from the special insight. So, Weka then attended on Bodhidharma for 8 years. One time, Weka asked Bodhidharma, "Can I hear the seal of Buddha Dharma?" And Bodhidharma said, "The seal of Buddha Dharma cannot be acquired from another, or from a person, or from hearing." Once Bodhidharma said, this is another one that my teacher liked to quote frequently, "Outwardly cease all involvements, inwardly have no mental agitation." Literally, "Inwardly have no coughing or sighing in the mind. With your mind like a wall, you enter the way. Outwardly cease all involvements," which later Weka said, "I've ceased all involvements." He's kind of reporting on how that practice is going for him. Right? "Outwardly cease all involvements with outer things. Inwardly have no mental agitation. With your mind like a wall, you enter the way." That smooth precipice of miles high wall. That wall that as we crawl along and has no edges or boundaries. So smooth that anything you throw at it just slides right off it. With a mind like a wall, you enter the way. Even though Hueca often spoke about mind and nature, he still did not become one with the truth. Bodhidharma just pointed out his errors without speaking of the essence of mind, which is free from thought, or without speaking of the essence of mind as the freedom from thoughts. The profound functioning within the room, an old Zen text says, once Hueca was attending Bodhidharma while they were climbing Shao Shur Peak. Bodhidharma asked him, which way does the path go? And Hueca said, go straight ahead, that's it. And Bodhidharma said, if you try to continue straight ahead, you won't be able to move a single step. And when Hueca heard this, he was awakened. Maybe all these stories are little awakenings, but this one's pointed out as saying that with that story, he was awakened. Which way does the path go? Go straight ahead, and that's it. Bodhidharma says, but if you go straight ahead, you won't be able to actually move a single step at all. Once Hueca said to Bodhidharma, I've ended all involvements, and so on, as in the story we've heard. And Bodhidharma said, have no doubt. Finally, Bodhidharma conferred the robe and Dharma to Hueca, saying, within, the seal of Dharma is transmitted, thus confirming awakened mind. Without, or externally, the robe is conferred, thus establishing the true lineage. So this transmission is the Dharma within, confirming awakened mind, but the robe is the external sign. Consequently, after Bodhidharma died, the master succeeded him and established the mysterious style of Bodhidharma. When Hueca conferred the Dharma to his own successor, Song San, he said, I still have some karma from former lives, and now I have to pay for it. Conferring the Dharma on Song San, he then taught the Dharma in the capital of Ye as circumstances allowed, and all kinds of people took refuge with him. He spent 30 years doing this, concealing his light and obliterating all traces of his status as the second ancestor, mixing with ordinary people, sometimes entering the wine shops and the butcher stalls, sometimes engaging in street talk, sometimes joining the workers who empty the privies. He, like, got down and dirty in the streets, Hueca. And some people who knew that he was the second ancestor said, the master is a man of the way. Why do you do these things? And Hueca replied, I'm just training my own mind. Why should that concern you? Later, he expounded the essentials of Dharma beneath the gates of Guangzhou Monastery, and all the assembly gathered in hordes. At that time, there was a Dharma teacher who was teaching the Nirvana Sutra at the monastery, but when people heard Hueca's talks, they gradually left that dry teaching about the sutras and went to Hueca's talks instead. And that teacher, of course, got angry. Just like in the last story. There's all these jealous Dharma teachers when Zen people come on the scene, right? And so he slandered Hueca to a local official. Uh-oh. You don't want to get the local officials involved. Deluded by this wicked talk, the local official accused the master of teaching false doctrine. Heresy. And Hueca submitted peacefully to execution on the 16th day of the third month of 593. These first ancestors in China, they got a rough time, right? Bodhidharma was poisoned 5 times, and Huaike was executed. But, you know, they did this for us. We wouldn't be here, right, without them. We really wouldn't be here today without them. I don't know where we would be, but we wouldn't be here in a Zen center. There wouldn't be Zen centers. These are our ancestors. Keizan says, to begin with, though there's no superiority or inferiority in the merits of these ancestors, Huaike is the most honored of the honored and most revered of the revered. The reason is that even though Bodhidharma came from India, if Huaike had not transmitted and spread the Dharma, the teaching would not have come down to the present. His sufferings were greater than anyone's. His aspiration be beyond that of others. The first ancestor Bodhidharma did not speak for a long time while he waited for a true person and did not give any special teachings to the second ancestor. He just said, put an end to all involvements and inwardly have no mental agitation. With the mind like a wall, you enter the way. Truly, if you stop thinking in this way, you will reveal the essence of mind. Hearing such words, you might try to become mindless, like a wall. This is not the intimate experience of mind. Huaike said, I'm always clearly aware. That's not mindless. If you can become like this, this is what the Buddhas have verified. Therefore, if you put an end to conditions externally, the many thoughts will no longer arise internally. Without becoming darkened, you will be alert, clear, and originally bright. You will not divide past and present, nor will you separate self and others. Because there's not a hair's tip of difference between what the Buddha's verified and the mind that has been transmitted by the ancestors, being completely merged and identical, this has been transmitted in India and China and unites China and Japan and America. It has been so in the past and it remains so now. So don't just yearn for the past. You must practice without finding fault with the present. Do not think that it's been a long time since we left the sage Shakyamuni. Do not give up on yourself. Just clarify yourself. As usual, I have some humble words. Would you like to hear them? In the realm that is empty and bright, conditions and thoughts are exhausted. It is clear, alert, and always bright. Translation. Empty yet radiantly bright, conditioned thought ended. Clear, lucid, aware, always open and clear. It's a lot of words these ancestors have to say, but they're speaking about something excruciatingly and maddeningly simple. So simple that it's very, very difficult to accord with it. So simple that it can't be seen or gotten a hold of. So simple it can't be turned away from or lost. So simple that it's very hard to trust. may we continue to sit in the boundless, luminous space that can't be touched or turned away from, that it's not something that we are, it's more that it is us. May our intention equally extend to every being and place, so that all may realize Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.